A group of scientists called World Weather Attribution released a report finding intense summer rains in Western Europe are more likely and will happen more often in the coming years due to climate change. How can they know that?
So I'm not familiar with the specifics of that study, but I'm assuming that they have studied climate models that have projected for that particular region, that as they go through time, although they can't attribute any individual event to climate change, they can see that the models very clearly project an increasing probability of events of that magnitude to occur as the climate warms and we move through the 21st century.
Well, listeners, I'll put a link to that report in my show blog at ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. Alex with Jesse Norris, UCLA.
If the skies can just open up and pour like we have never seen, and that's well beyond our drains and our local waterways to handle, and probably beyond our insurance company's ability to handle, this makes a warming world sound like an even more unstable place to be, in addition to the heating, which we've all talked about. Is that what you think is developing?
What do you mean by more unstable?
Well, you know, the concert in Central Park on August 21st, We Love New York City homecoming concert, was suddenly rained down, more rain in 2 hours than ever recorded in Central Park, and they have records going back a long way. It just seems like you can't count on much if you have rains that are beyond what we've seen before.
That's right, yeah. Also, although the projection in a lot of regions is that there will be more dry periods, when those big rain events do come, they're going to be all the more intense. So, for example, here in Southern California, we go months and months without precipitation, but then we'll just have a huge deluge just in the space of a couple of weeks. So that's a particularly extreme case, but it seems that the projections around the world are for that to be, as you state, more unstable, so that you can expect it, both extreme dry periods, but also more extreme rain when it does come.
Rain and weather's always been uneven and difficult to predict, especially for smaller regions. As your paper explains, there are so many variable factors, from short-term forces to very long cycles. But before the new methods used by your team, it seems scientists were unable to clearly prove that extreme precipitation events during the last century have increased. Is that the case?
So it's not completely accurate that other studies haven't been able to show intensification of precipitation. So generally, the previous studies have been restricted to specific regions. And so previous studies have shown that in specific regions that precipitation has been intensifying in recent decades. But because of the natural variability in the climate system, you can always get some regions where you might see an intensification, and then some regions where you might see a weakening. So the goal of this study was to bring all of the regions on Earth together and say collectively, are the regions where precipitation has been intensifying, are there enough of those to say that on a global scale that this is happening, and it's more than what we would just expect from noise? To do that, we used the novel machine learning method.
I got to ask you about that. Artificial neural networks, or ANN, dare we mere mortals ask, what is that? What is machine learning, and how did you use it?
So I was not the lead author on this study, so I'm not intricately involved with the technical details here, but just on a conceptual level, it's where we, in this case, we feed in global maps of extreme precipitation. So we feed in global maps each year, and so we see the evolution of the global distribution of extreme precipitation over time, and then in terms of that spatial structure from a global perspective, the machine is able to interpret those maps and say, okay, the ones that you're feeding us from more recently, I can tell the difference between those and the ones that you're feeding me from, say, the early 20th century. That it can tell that the maps in more recent times are profoundly different because precipitation is intensifying in sufficiently many regions that it's beyond what could be expected from noise.
I think that's amazing science, and I don't know how far artificial intelligence can take us, but nature's so complex, it looks like we're going to need something beyond our personal minds to crack it.
Yes, we're becoming extremely reliant on increasing computer power to solve the very complex mathematical and physical problems that are necessary to make reliable climate projections. And so, yes, our machine learning is becoming an increasingly useful tool for various applications of climate science, and it's able to process an amount of data which we are not able to do so at all, and make inferences about what is happening to the climate system as we progress through the 21st century. And so this is one particular application, but there are all sorts of other applications that are being used to be able to make inferences about what climate change is doing to, whether it's precipitation or temperature or winds or evaporation or whatever you like, which we would not be able to do without these sophisticated artificial intelligence.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Jesse Norris, postdoctoral atmospheric researcher at UCLA. We're talking about new science that can tell us more about deadly extreme rainfall events in many parts of the world. Well, I'm getting in over my head here, but we might as well take a shot at it. I read that your team found positive relevance for some parts of the world, including the East Asian monsoon and both North Pacific and North Atlantic storm tracks, but negative relevance for other parts of the world. What does that mean, and why is it important?
Okay, so as I alluded earlier, when we're looking at the global patterns of these precipitation events, and so the challenge is that there are, in fact, some regions where, a small number of regions, where precipitation has becoming weaker. So what we're trying to do is consider all of those regions together and say that collectively the globe is experiencing more extreme rainfall. And so in this context, where we refer to positive relevance, these are the regions such as the East Asian monsoon, as you mentioned, which is where the greater signal is being received. And then negative relevance are typically in the arid regions of the world, the Earth's deserts, where you're in fact seeing rainfall becoming less intense over time. And so the job of the neural network that's trying to solve this problem with artificial intelligence is to sort these regions with what we call positive relevance and negative relevance, and establish that the regions with positive relevance are in fact greater than those with negative relevance.
Well, you've just stimulated an interesting idea in me. We talk about extreme rainfall events, but maybe there are weakened rainfall events. I mean, sometimes here now, instead of a rain, we just see big splattery drops that are about a foot apart. You can almost walk in between the raindrops. Maybe there is a new kind of rain developing in the drier areas. What do you think?
Are you referring to in Canada there?
Well, in the desert areas of the West, let's say.
All right, yeah. Yeah, we're generally expecting a decrease in, so what we refer to as drizzle, we generally expect a decrease of that, and so we expect longer dry spells with completely blue skies and no precipitation. But when the really extreme storms happen, they are all the more intense. So that is something that is in fact projected to decrease in a warming climate. I suppose that can be almost considered as zero precipitation, the kind of events that you're referring to. But that the occurrence of something like that is not something that generally we would expect an increase of.
And this new paper, led by Gavin D. Matakumbura and the UCLA team, was published in the journal Nature on July 6, 2021, just a week before the freak floods in Northern Europe. That was pretty good timing, don't you think?
Yes, it was indeed. Yes, there, as well as there were extreme monsoon rains in India and in China with all sorts of devastating impacts. So, yeah, we would argue that whenever we published such a study. There are going to be examples around the world, whether it's in those regions that happens to experience those extreme events at that time, or if the study had been published at another time, then perhaps California or Australia or wherever else we might have seen. Although it's not something that is nice to hear about, that generally there are, whenever you might want to talk about this, there are examples right outside your door that you can look to.
No shortage of news stories about it, and I know that I'm going to be reporting on this for as long as we keep the show going. There's just going to be more shocking rainfall events. But the paper does note that the helpful results from machine learning do not include the possibility of rare events like a big volcanic eruption, and they may not account properly for long-term variability like the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. So if one of these years several volcanoes blow, could that throw off predictions about extreme rain and extreme drought?
Yes. So in the past, when we've seen major volcanic eruptions, that can actually result in a temporary global cooling. And so that has the tendency to have the opposite effect of what we're seeing in the longer term. So that can interrupt the long-term trend that we're seeing. But generally, these are these kind of events, even when they're volcanic eruptions of such intensity as, for example, Pinatubo in 1992, I believe, which caused global cooling for a few years and interrupted, led to what is often referred to as the global warming hiatus. These cooling events are always just very short-lived and ultimately are not changing the long-term trend that we have been seeing in recent decades and can expect to continue seeing.
Well, we know from the records that there was a super drought lasting hundreds of years in the American Southwest many hundreds of years ago, and that was not human-induced climate change. And likewise, Australia may have entered a long, wetter rain cycle just as the first European settlers arrived around the 1700s. How can we separate human-induced changes to rainfall from those deep historic patterns?
Generally, we look at the time scales of the variability. So in the past, we've always seen variability on the scale of tens of years, for example. But when we look at the temperature record going back to pre-industrial times, we can see a very clear warming trend, which is on a scale that is greater than what has been observed in terms of natural temperature variability. It's a challenge of separating the signal from the noise, and in this case we have enough of a signal to, so events that you refer to we would consider as noise in the grand scheme of things, and so in the data generally we see sufficient signal to be able to say that those kind of events are just natural variability and that they are ultimately dwarfed by the longer term warming trend, which in this case is leading to a longer term trend of intensifying rainfall.
A study published in June 2021 in Geophysical Research Letters found on our current emissions path, extreme storms over Europe might be up to 14 times more common by the year 2100 than they were in the year 2000. And that sounds pretty serious, not only in terms of human lives lost, but it's really costly to keep rebuilding when floods become common. Do you think planners and the rest of us are underestimating the growing threat of extreme precipitation and floods?
Absolutely, and I suppose it's impossible to try to imagine the scale of damage that can be done around the world and the rebuilding that will be necessary to compensate. So moving forward, some serious efforts should be taken, I suppose, to make the infrastructure more resilient to these kind of events, so that there isn't just this huge rebuilding effort each time. But that's certainly easier said than done. So I suppose it's not really our area to comment on what the response in terms of infrastructure and planning should be. But yes, in general, we can expect an increasing challenge to rebuild and prepare ourselves for the kind of flooding that in all areas around the world should become more frequent in the future.
In another area of your research, I have to say some scientific findings are unsatisfying for the rest of us because the conclusions often include a wide range of uncertainty. In a made-up example, I could just make it up. We could say we might get 2 to 12 more inches of rain by the 2040s, for example, but that's anything from a little more water to outright repeated floods included in that range. So, Jesse, you specialize in something called emergent constraints. What is that, and how can that help us?
So this is where we look at a range of projections from different climate models. So we have many climate models available, which different modeling centers around the world produce. And then in general, the scientific community tries to put all of these models together because we know that there's a wide range in projections from different models. And so we try to put all of the models together so that collectively they can perhaps make some insightful projections. And so because of the large spread in projections from different models, this leads us to the notion of what we call emergent constraints, which is where we identify a relationship between the model spread in our projected metric, for example, how much precipitation will intensify in the future, and we relate this to the model spread in a metric which is measurable by observations. So those same models that make projections are also used to model the current climate, which is, of course, observable because we have all sorts of weather stations measuring precipitation and everything else.
As we wrap up here, Jesse, are there any other thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I would just reiterate that this our study, as well as many others, showing that what has already been observed historically shows very clear evidence that the warming climate has been leading to intensified precipitation events. And so what this study is essentially doing is validating the models that we are using to make projections for the 21st century. And so given this validation of the models, this makes it important to listen to what those models are projecting for the 21st century, which is that precipitation events are going to be intensifying far beyond what we've already witnessed in recent decades. And so this is something that should be taken into account and prepared for from a societal level, because unfortunately we do expect these kind of events to intensify beyond what has been observed thus far.
As Bob Dylan said, a hard rain is going to fall. We have been speaking with Dr. Jesse Norris, postdoctoral researcher at the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the University of California, Los Angeles. Find links to his latest work and news articles about this summer's surprise floods in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jesse, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Nice talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
EcoShock 2006.
The White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and climate change has become the preeminent case study of the contamination of our political process by money.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. For 31 years, Ross Gelbspan was an investigative reporter and editor for the Philadelphia Bulletin, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe. His work led to a Pulitzer Prize. Retiring in 1998, he wrote the book The Heat Is On, The Climate Crisis, The Cover-Up, The Prescription. President Clinton read it. His 2004 book is Boiling Point, reviewed in the New York Times by Al Gore. Gelbspan has appeared at the World Economic Forum and regularly in the largest American media. His latest speech was organized by Mark Breslow of the Mass Climate Action Network. The topic is Straddling Between Solutions and Survivalism. Getting published on global warming has been a challenge for even top-named reporters like Ross Gelbspan. He explains the huge gulf in media and public awareness between America and other parts of the world, particularly Europe. Other governments and publics have long recognized the dangers of climate change. This barrier to information in America has become a fixation for Gelbspan. He has taken a lead in exposing the corruption of the public mind, oiled by millions in propaganda dollars from the fossil fuel industry. He says the major media outlets are blinkered, seeing politics in everything, so they fail to cover issues outside the political sphere, like science, for example. Facts are not political.
The White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and climate change has become the preeminent case study of the contamination of our political process by money. This fusion of corporate interests and government power has proved an almost insurmountable obstacle to the climate movement's ability to get its larger message across. So I think a really critical focus for climate activists should be on the press. And I know from my own experience that when the press covers an issue thoroughly and consistently, the public responds, laws get passed. I think in this case it would mobilize the public in 6 months. Unfortunately, the industry public relations specialists have been so successful in promoting equivocal and confusing climate coverage that the American public is about 10 years behind the rest of the world in this area. There are a number of reasons for this, none of them really justifiable. Let me just go through one of scores of these reasons for why the press behaves the way it does. One reason, I think, is the fact that the career path at the top of news outlets normally follows lies in following the track of political reporting. Top editors tend to see all issues through a political lens. Early in his administration, and this is one example, President Bush declared he would not accept the findings of the IPCC because they represent foreign science, even though half the scientists who contribute to the IPCC are American scientists. Instead, Bush called on the U.S. National Academy of Sciences to provide American science. What I found astounding was this. Even as the Washington Press Corps reported the story, not one reporter that I saw bothered to check the position of the NAS. Had they done so, they would have found that as early as 1992, 3 years before the IPCC declared that we are changing the climate, the NAS was pushing for strong measures to minimize the impacts of human-induced global warming.
Some of Gelbspan's most famous reporting exposed the links between fossil fuel corporations and a handful of paid scientists who implanted the impression of a debate within science about the human role in climate change. But there was no debate in scientific journals or among thousands of experts in the field. Gelbspan compared this effort to cloud our thinking to the public relations efforts of the tobacco lobby, who found experts to deny that smoking caused cancer. History may find the Exxon and Peabody lobbyists help kill more people than the tobacco industry as climate change unfolds in floods, heat waves, droughts, and storms. Some have argued that the foundation of newspaper sales and television viewers is controversy and conflict. So the media simply fell into their old model to sell the fake climate controversy supplied by public relations companies and their paid hack experts. Gelbspan, who knows the media industry as well as anyone, doesn't let the press off so easily. He says irreparable damage has been done to the planet while valuable years were wasted in denial, led by the mainstream media. As he digs away at the black dollars that bought time for ever-growing and excessive profits for the fossil fuel industry, Ross finds the media as guilty as the carbon kings. Let's listen to a few clips from his recent speech, starting with the fake debate.
The next reason has to do with this campaign of disinformation launched by the coal industry and carried forward by ExxonMobil. As I mentioned, the fossil fuel lobby paid a tiny handful of scientists to dismiss the reality of climate change. That campaign has had a profoundly corrosive effect on journalists by insisting this issue of climate change be cast as a debate, when in fact there is no debate whatsoever in the community of mainstream scientists. When it's a story involving opinion, a journalist is ethically obligated to give the major competing points of view their best shot, their about equal space, and their most articulate presentation. But when it's a question of fact, it's up to a reporter to get off his or her butt and find out what the facts are. In this case, we know what the facts are.
Reporters and editors, Gelbspan says, have broken the public trust on the environment story. Isn't this media denial handy for all of us? Why should we make personal sacrifices or expect expensive action by government or big business if we aren't sure about it? The fossil fuel companies know full well that many of us wish the whole greenhouse gas problem would just float away into the sky along with our exhaust. As his speech develops, Gelbspan seems to say the public might be panicked if it knew the true extent of damage already done to the climate.
As one co-chair of the IPCC said to me, there is no debate among any statured scientists working on this issue about the larger trends of what is happening to the climate. That is something you would never know from American press coverage. But it is something you should point out to every editor and reporter you encounter as you work to get your message out. Stop approaching reporters like beggars asking for a handout. Let them know how angry you are at them for allowing themselves to be conned into betraying their public trust. One researcher who surveyed more than 300 peer-reviewed research articles a couple of years ago found that not one questioned the larger consensus about human-induced warming. By contrast, much of the coverage in the U.S. continues to cast this issue as a debate, and that's exactly what the public relations specialists of big coal and big oil want. They don't care who wins the debate as long as the public perceives it to be a debate. And that way people can shrug their shoulders and walk away and say, come back and tell us what you know when you really know what you're talking about. To keep the issue framed as a debate allows the public to avoid confronting what can be a frightening and potentially emotionally overwhelming threat.
Gelbspan was asked to leave the audience with a note of optimism, but he changed his title to reflect the divided feelings many in the field hold. His new title, Straddling Between Solutions and Survivalism. I think we're going to need both, ways to survive a very bumpy transition to a carbonless, sustainable economy, even while we implement the solutions that will save future generations from hell on earth. We're going to get some of both, folks. There is a whole chorus of people, from net bloggers to senior scientists, who are thinking about survivalism if we can't adapt our political and economic systems soon enough. Things may fall apart.
Because of the success of this deeply dishonest campaign of information control, we find ourselves today in a sort of schizophrenic predicament. We are torn between the promise of solutions and the impulse towards survivalism. The situation is that dire.
Meanwhile, this seasoned journalist pleads for everyone to drop the political angle. Climate change doesn't care about conservatives, liberals, or even greens, for that matter. Greenhouse gases operate by the laws of physics, not by the grace of campaign donations. Here is a short list of conservatives who warned about climate change.
For example, many editors view climate change as a kind of proxy issue for political liberals. That's not the case. The earliest and very forceful advocate on this stuff was Margaret Thatcher, Britain's conservative prime minister. William F. Buckley has published serious warnings about global warming. Jim Woolsey, former CIA director, and Republican Senator Richard Lugar had a long piece in Foreign Affairs a couple of years ago about the need to deal with climate change. President Bush's first Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill, has likened the coming impacts of climate change to a nuclear holocaust. And the one senator taking the lead to regulate carbon emissions is conservative Senator John McCain. It would be really useful if journalists were to spend a bit of time examining the real rather than the assumed politics of climate change.
I rate Ross Gelbspan up there with the great climate communicators like Al Gore, George Monbiot, Elizabeth Colbert, and Mark Linus. I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock at www.
This is Bird Note. Hummingbirds are alluring birds. People are often enamored by their iridescent feathers and charismatic personalities. But for some species of mites, the attraction is electric. Mites are tiny critters related to spiders and ticks. There are thousands, if not millions, of species worldwide that are typically no larger than a grain of salt. Being so small, many mites rely on larger animals to survive. In the neotropics, hummingbird flower mites freeload off an existing partnership. This group of mites feeds on nectar and pollen, but only from specific types of flowers. These picky eaters need reliable transport between blooms that may be yards apart, basically a squillion miles to an itty-bitty mite. Without wheels or wings of their own, these mites hitch a ride on a passing hummingbird. As the hummingbird takes a sip from a favored flower, the mites make a mad dash for its bill. With help from static electricity, the mites zap onto the bird like lint to fresh laundry. Once safely on board, they tuck themselves into the hummingbird's nostrils until the hitchhikers can safely disembark at the bird's next stop. In fact, scientists have discovered that these teeny mites have evolved the ability to detect the electric fields generated by the whirring birds, a sense called electroreception. Sharks use this to hunt prey. These mites are just looking for their next nostril. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.